Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So 7 years ago, my guest today published what has become an underground hit on masculinity. His name is Jack Donovan, and that book was The Way of Men. I had Jack on the podcast a few years ago to discuss that book. Check it out if you haven't listened to it yet. Anyways, in The Way of Men, Donovan argued that for men to really live what he calls the tactical virtues of masculinity, they needed to form an all-male honor group, or what he calls a gang. In his latest book, Becoming a Barbarian, Donovan lays out what creating these honor groups would look like. And on today's show, Jack and I discuss why masculinity is often tragic, why today's modern world makes it hard for men to form male honor groups, the difference between a club and a tribe, and what it means to start the world. After the show is over, check out the show notes at aom.is/barbarian, where you can get links and resources to delve deeper into this topic. Jack Donovan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, man.
All right, so your last book was The Way of Men, which has kind of become this underground cult classic among men. So what's been the reaction to that book? And I mean, what kind of guys are reading it, and what are the responses you're getting from them?
Well, the reaction to the book, I mean, I never imagined when I wrote it that, you know, I'd end up selling, I think I've probably sold about 50,000 copies worldwide.
That's insane, dude.
Yeah. I mean, it's been translated into Portuguese and French. It just came out in Deutschland this past month. And I mean, it's blown me away. And I think the reaction that I get is that The Way of Men put something, you know, in a way that a lot of men had always felt but couldn't articulate. And I get that over and over again. It's like I get these guys who, you know, they're like, oh, I thought I was the only one who was seeing things this way, or who thought it this way. And, you know, this is the first time I've actually read it. You know, I've always just assumed that, you know, people who were writing were saying one thing and I was thinking a different thing. And so a lot of people have really latched into it. I have, you know, guys, I think the most thing that honors me the most is you know, when guys buy copies for their sons that were just born, right. And I'm gonna give this to him when he's 13, you know. And that's pretty amazing. That blows me away. And I've also had a lot of interest, you know. I mean, there's some guys who, you know, obviously the people who react negatively to it, you know, a lot of them will think that I'm some kind of that I think I'm the ultimate man, that I'm trying to you know, tell them how to be men, and you know, and I haven't gotten a lot of that, but the people who think that obviously haven't read the introduction, because I kind of say right away that's not what I'm about. But the guys who get it, it's really cool. I have a lot of guys that I always say my readers are better than me, and not all of them, but I have a lot of readers who are really accomplished guys, you know, special forces guys. A lot of them, you know, people who have, you know, been successful in business and you know, or lifting or whatever, and they contact me and they realize that I'm just a guy who was trying to figure something out, and they contact me and they want to share their skills with me and hang out, and that's really cool. That's really exciting.
Yeah, so you've been doing a lot of like tactical training and things like that, right?
Yeah. I did some long range shooting with Leupold Optics last weekend, and that was I didn't think I would like that, and I it was really fun. So you know, that was pretty exciting, and you know, doing some gun stuff with my guy Greg up in Seattle, Insights, and you know, there've been more and more opportunities like that opening up. So that's really exciting.
That is really cool. And do you know if your book's been picked up by any gender studies programs? Like, your book like ranks high in that segment on Amazon.
It's kind of funny, which means that they know who I am. But, and I think that it actually has been part of some curriculums. I mean, I every once in a while I hear that someone's teaching in a class. I know it's in some libraries and stuff like that. You know, I don't get a lot of notification about stuff like that.
Right.
So,
yeah, I was curious. I mean, because it is sort of, I mean, it's up there with some of those, you know, books about masculinity, that, because there aren't really a lot of books about masculinity in the gender studies area, or if there are, they're coming from like a feminist standpoint.
Yeah. It's like you and me and Iron John. It's like the only Amazon ranking thing, right? It's like you and me and Iron John and
maybe Harvey Mansfield's manliness.
Every once in a while, I mean, it's something like that. And then, it's more like feminist books. It's just like we're up at the top there. And weirdly, Hunter S. Thompson's book on the Hell's Angels is in there for some reason. But
I guess that kind of makes sense. It's a gang, right?
It makes sense. It's just kind of funny that it was categorized that way.
Right, yeah. Yeah, sometimes you see style. Sometimes I see how my book is categorized, and it's bizarre. So you find my books in, the trivia section. All right, so let's talk about your new book. It's called Becoming a Barbarian. How is this a continuation of your work in The Way of Men?
All right, well, obviously, at the end of The Way of Men, it says that men should, start a gang or start a tribe. And, obviously the response that I was getting from that was, how? What do I do? They want this kind of perfect guaranteed plan. And I'm like, well, to begin with, if you, from what I've learned actually, kind of joining a tribe on my own, is that, if you want a perfect plan that's guaranteed to work, you probably aren't the guy who should be running the tribe. Because it's a creative enterprise. You have to make it up as you go along, and obviously there's some basic rules. We borrowed a lot of structures for our tribe from motorcycle clubs, just because they've been working for years and years and years. But what I also found is that people said they wanted to join a tribe or a gang, but they weren't ready. Like psychologically, they weren't ready. And I thought that was more important for me to talk about because I have no experience running a tribe for like 20 years. I mean, that's the guy who should write a book on how to run a tribe. In terms of the changes of the mind that have to happen to become part of a tribe instead of just a club, I think people are confusing tribe and gang and club, but I think when it comes to being part of a tribe, it means that you have a shared fate. And you have this honor group that you can't turn away from when you don't like what they're saying. You still have to deal with them and you still have to live up to their expectations. And that's the kind of tribe I was in, or the kind of gang that I was suggesting that people start. This one that you can't just be like, this isn't working out, walk away, And so I don't think that men were ready to really break away from modern life to the extent that they could really give themselves 100% to a group.
Right. We'll talk about that mindset shift change that needs to take place. We've written a lot about it on our site about, this community mindset that I think a lot of people, particularly in America, have lost. Let's start off with this. You start off the chapter in your book, Becoming the Barbarian, that masculinity is tragic, which I thought was interesting. What do you mean by that? And why does masculinity require conflict?
Well, I had a young guy write me, and he said that chapter was really depressing. And I'm like, well, life is kind of depressing if you look at it in a certain way. We're born and we get all these skills and we get better at everything, and then we all start to fall apart and die. And that's pretty depressing. But the same thing is true of masculinity. I mean, life is tragic in that way, and masculinity is also tragic. Because you strive to become a man, and eventually you're not going to be as good at all these things that these skills that you acquired. I mean, you become a great fighter, and eventually you're not going to be a great fighter. You become a great race car driver, and eventually you're going to crash one too many times. And there's an end to it. And that's what I think is depressing to a lot of people, because you do all this work and eventually it all falls apart. Or it's also depressing because maybe you don't get to be the top guy. And most people never will. Most guys will never be at the top of the food chain as in any group of men. So that's kind of depressing as well. And so, just as in with life, obviously you're here for, a short period of time, and it becomes what you make of it. And so, you want to be the best man that you can be. And without conflict, I always say your life is a story where nothing happened. Because, you can't have a plot without conflict. It's a show that no one would watch. And conflict allows men, that's how we test each other. And without that testing, if we're always safe, if we're always, you know, protected from each other, then, you know, we can't really grow as men. I mean, that's how we become the kind of men that we're all saying, you know, are, you know, gone from this earth, or there're fewer of them, or, you know, masculinity our generations are weaker than the ones that came before. And, you know, because we've eliminated conflict. And, you know, I think you may have even recommended it to me, but I just got around to listening to some of the audiobook of that book by Taleb, Antifragile.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a lot of the same ideas. If you deal with conflict all the time and you learn how to, you know, operate within some kind of chaos, then you're going to become maybe more resilient, maybe more robust, and possibly even more anti-fragile. But if you are constantly protected, you are reliant on that protection.
Right. And also, I mean, you've written about this too, and we've written about it too, and sort of this is based in, you know, sociology, psychology, evolutionary biology, that one of the defining traits of males across species, particularly, you know, our close primate relatives, is that the way the males differentiate themselves is conflict. Like they, within the group, right, there's sort of this intra-tribal or intra-group competition, but then there's also competition or conflict between competing groups. And that's like how you create an individual, or at least for males, that's what they sort of create their psyche around.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then I think so there's this great book, if you haven't read it yet, check it out, is Fighting for Life. It's written by this Jesuit priest who's like a philosophy professor. And it's all about like this male competitive drive. And he has made this really interesting point. He gets kind of Freudian, which can get goofy sometimes. But like the males at least, or boys, have like they're in conflict from the day they're born. Like they're inside a woman and they have to like battle the estrogen that might be, you know, trying to make them more womanlike. And then once they're outside of the womb, they have to like differentiate themselves and separate themselves from their mother. And like girls don't have to do that, right? Like they can identify
with their mother. I mean, they always say like women are always, you're always a woman, you know, like manhood is something that you have to earn. Like women just kind of, womanhood kind of happens. And no one says you're not a woman because you don't do this or this. I mean, there are some reasons why you might not be, but that, you know, they're mostly chemical in nature. But it definitely does sound pretty Freudian.
Yeah.
But and I actually use Freud in this book as well. I mean, it's just a model. And if you don't get crazy where everything's about your mother, then it's all right.
Right. Yeah. Nothing about your mother, your dad.
Yeah. No, but you know, I mean, I use him for the model of the self schema or whatever. You know, the there's a great model called the iceberg, I think, about like, you know, superego and ego and id, and I think that, you know, what's below the consciousness and what's above it, and you know, what makes you. And I think he was right about a lot of that.
Right. So, you know, you argue in The Way of Men, and this is what Becoming a Barbarian is about, is that manliness, you know, to fully express masculinity requires a group of guys. It requires a tribe, gang, platoon, posse, whatever you want to call it. But I think, you know, us modern Americans take pride in our hyper-individualism. I think there's a tendency in a lot of men today saying that, you know, joining a group is for suckers, it's for sheeple, and like a real man is like the lone alpha wolf who does his thing. So why is it not possible to like fully experience masculinity by yourself, and you need to be embedded in a group of men?
Well, I mean, I guess you could, I was going to say you could experience, but no, I actually don't think you can. I mean, I think that, you know, like I said, we need that competition, that feedback from other men. I mean, if you're the lone guy off on your own forever, I mean, there's part of your experience that's missing, because humans are not solitary animals. We are social animals, and masculinity is a social phenomenon to a certain degree. And you know, but and as far as Americans and individualism goes, I mean, man, that was my favorite chapter in that book. That's the one that I got most excited about. That belonging is becoming, just because there's so many guys who think they're so special, and they're not. Yeah, and they think that their opinion is so important. And you see them arguing on the internet, and you know, like you know, their individual opinion is, you know, they'll live and die by it, and they cannot join a group because there's some little detail that they can find that they you know wouldn't want to agree with, or they want to reserve their right to disagree, and so they're alone. Is the consequence of that is that they're just alone, and I was talking to a guy the other day. Obviously, I'm not going to mention his name, but he said that we were talking about our, you know, a lot of guys talk about your bury a body buddy. You know, like, who are you going to call when you have to do something that maybe involves breaking the law, or that you maybe, you know, that involves something that it was way beyond what you can handle by yourself. And, you know, he was like, you know, this guy who was I was talking about with, he was pretty squared away. You know, he was, pretty advanced in the military and probably had killed a lot of people and had a lot of survival skills. But at the end of the day, I mean, he's still concerned about who am I going to call? And a lot of guys, you know, they think, you know, they're far less skilled than him, think, oh, well, I can handle anything that comes my way. But at the end of the day, you can't. And so when you can't, you depend on the government. And that's why, you know, again, comes back to the anti-fragile thing. Like, people try and create more and more and more and more and more security for themselves. But it's a security that's a dependent security. And they, you know, they're relying on the state to jump in and be their best friend when something goes wrong. And I think that, as individualist as these guys think that they are, and, you know, maybe if you're a billionaire, you just hire a lot of people to do that work for you. But most of us aren't. And so we need friends. And I think that having relationships with other men is a rich part of our lives that we're missing. And, I mean, men understand each other in ways that men and women don't. And, and in many ways, I think a lot of those guys who end up loners end up having themselves defined by women because, you know, that's ends up being the most important person in their life. And their best friend and their only best friend. And so, you know, their masculinity becomes defined by her. And so, you know, I think that's a very Hollywood idea. It's just kind of, you know, this rolling tumbleweed of violence and judgment, you know, that comes from Clint Eastwood movies that, you know, the real man is a loner all by himself. But in reality, the real man gets picked off really easily.
Right, right. And like, yeah, you know, whenever people say, like, I'm the alpha or I'm the lone wolf, it's like, you do know the lone wolves are the ones who got kicked out of the pack. Like, they were like, they were the runts that no one want, like the wolves didn't want.
Yeah, yeah. You're like this guy that can't get along with anyone. It's not 90% of the time, that's the case. It's like the lone wolf is the guy who just can't get along with anyone. He's kind of a jerk, you know?
Yeah. And then, I mean, so this idea of belonging is becoming... I mean, so how can group affiliation, you know, belonging to a tightly knit community or tribe, whatever you want to call it, can make you a more interesting individual?
Well, I just think it fills out. You know yourself more because you've been tested in different ways and people have demanded things from you. Because, you know, if you're just demanding things of yourself, I mean, you know, I try and push myself all the time. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, ways that I'm only... Yeah, I'm the only one driving myself. No one really cares what I do. But, you know, having these other guys, you know, to answer to, I think, you know, really kind of enriches your life. You know, I say, obviously, you know, I'm oathed into a tribe and, you know, I have to think about what, you know, how my actions are going to affect all those guys and what they would think of what I'm doing. And that's kind of the basis of where honor comes from. And, you know, if I can't answer to them, maybe I shouldn't do it. And, you know, people call that groupthink, but, you know, I think that's again, human nature. And I think that people who think they don't engage in groupthink, I can see them online engaging in groupthink all the time.
Right, so, right, right.
Yeah. I mean, no one's really that, you know, immune from that. They just kind of like flatter themselves by saying that they are.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's interesting too. I came across, like right before the interview, I came across this study about, you know, everyone trying to be individual, right? They did a sociological study. Everyone who tries to be individual, unique, butterfly, whatever, like it actually ends up creating this like just monoculture of just uniqueness. That like, there's like nothing different between anybody because everyone's trying to be unique. So everyone is the same.
Well, it becomes very consumer based as well. Like you're not really separate from this monoculture. Because you're all in it and you're all alone. So how do you differentiate yourself? Well, you buy things. You know, you buy, you know, like what, you know, what the hat is the best hat for me. What is, you know, what band? Oh, it's always bands. It's yeah. People. It's, you know, people, it's like what kind of music your life, says something about you as a person. And they define themselves in these, you know, kind of superficial ways that, you know, that are easy to change. You know, if they come up against resistance, then, I don't like that anymore. Or I was just kidding. That's kind of like the modern kind of hipster way of looking at everything. You know, like, if you like something that other people don't like, then you can always fall back on the idea that you were just kidding and you weren't really serious. And, it's just a cowardly way of living.
Yeah. I mean, I think like Amish people, like an Amish person would be more interesting to me than some just regular guy, you know, who's just, you know, buying consumer stuff, trying to differentiate himself. Like I would like be more interested in like sitting down and talking to an Amish guy about his life.
Oh yeah. I mean, cause they have a distinct and different culture. They didn't just make different consumer choices. You know, they have a whole life that is different.
So let's talk about this. I mean, so tribe is the goal, but it seems like, and this is what a lot of what you write about in the book, is that modernity makes it difficult for men, women, I mean, everyone to be a part right. of a tribe or a community. So what is it about modernity that makes that difficult?
Well, I mean, to begin with, we're very separate from each other. I mean, in the way that it's the way we make money is organized. I mean, we're not 10 farmers living within like a few miles of each other. Because that the community kind of forms itself, you know, at that point. We're a bunch of people who, you know, you're together until your career takes you to this place, your career takes you to that place, or, you know, and you all spend more time at work than you spend with anyone else. And so it makes it hard. I mean, it's hard to have friends in modern life, let alone a tribe. It's hard to make time for the people you really like in your life. You actually have to go out of your way to do it. And, that's one of the things that we look for in our group. It's like, are you willing to like give up something so that you can be here? Because if you're not, then we're not going to waste your time. But, and then there's so many distractions. Another reader actually sent me a book called Deep Work and talked a lot about the distractions of, you know, social media and everything. Everybody's constantly in a state of distraction and they don't know how to focus or locked down on anything anymore. But, and the world is very anti-tribal as well. I mean, everything, you know, if you Google the word tribalism, it's basically negative. It's kind of like masculinity. It's mostly about toxic tribalism and bad tribalism. And they don't use the word that much in America. They're using it a little bit more in terms of politics, you know, the way that Americans are divided. But and just rabidly divided, and I think that that's just human nature and that's normal. But they think that no matter how big the group is, we're all supposed to learn to love each other. And people who think tribally don't think that way. They think my group is my group and your group is your group, and we can get along until we don't. And that's, I think globalism makes that's something that really people who are in favor of globalism and big business and so forth. Don't want, because it's a problem. You know, it creates disruption in the system. If you have groups that cannot work together, you have problems, with your government, with your, employee relations, you have problems with your entire system is, you have people within it that are kind of at odds with each other. And, it would be much better for everybody if we were all just kind of loners who think we're individualists. And, then we can just buy things and then that'll be much easier for everyone. I mean, like the United Nations is against tribalism. It's a big thing. You know, I mean, the goal has been for a long time to turn everything into these bigger and bigger and bigger groups. And that really, to my mind, is not as idealistic as it is to facilitate commerce.
Right, right. I mean, like, yeah, whenever you make people, everyone think like they're the same, like it makes it easier to sell to, right? Like you're actually, you're like more control. Actually, we had a guy, Matthew Crawford, who he got his new book. He did a shop class of Soulcraft, but he got a new book about the world beyond your head. And he talks about that, like sort of these things that make us feel like we have more control, right? Like companies want us to make us feel like we're individuals. Like it allows them to control us easier.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Cause they're just dealing with the individual who is not connected with anyone else, and they don't have really a culture or like a identity. And so they can like, hey, I can sell you this. I can sell you your identity and here you go.
Oh yeah. That's most of what they do, you know?
So, I mean, like, how do you counter that? I mean, it takes relearning how to live in a way that, you know, humans have lived for most of humanity. Like, how do you go about learning and overcoming that sort of culture that we have that says, no, that's not the best way to do it?
Well, obviously, to begin with, you have to want to. And, you know, most people don't because it's hard. You know, and nobody wants to be different. And they want to be different in a way that's like cute and like, you know, like I said, they can back away from. But I mean, that's why the book was really called Becoming a Barbarian, is because you have to understand that you're doing something that society doesn't want and you have to make peace with it. You know, this is civilization is anti-tribal, like the civilization we have right now. It is anti-tribal. And so by becoming more tribal, you're going to say things and live in a way that makes people uncomfortable, and they may even hate you for it. And you have to be wearing, the slogan for the book is "Caput Gerat Lupinum," which is, with the head of a wolf. You have to realize that you're an outsider to them. You're an insider to your own tribe, but you're going to be an outsider to them. And so that's, you know, something people have to make peace with to do that. But you know, in order to do it, I mean, that's kind of what the whole book is about, going through this thought process of breaking away and thinking about things in a group sense instead of the global group. We're all taught to, you know, that we're supposed to care about everything that happens everywhere, and humans really can't. So I feel like it's very media directed and very fake. Do you really care about this disaster that happened to these strangers 40,000, you know, 50 miles away or 5,000 miles away? Probably not. We're kind of trained to feel bad about that in the way that we feel bad for, you know, in watching a movie. But, people, you know, worse things are probably happening next door to you to people that you don't, you know, that you don't know or care about because you don't know. It's like the media tells you to care, so you care.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the first things, is kind of breaking away from that cycle of like, what everyone is caring about today, I have to care about. And it's actually made it hard for me to write anymore because I have done that. And I actually took a 6-month break from Facebook where I kind of gave my password and everything to one of my buddies. And he kind of acted as my assistant for a while. And, when I came back to it, it was amazing to me, because I had been in that cycle, my entire writing career. Of looking at what everybody's talking about today, and that's what we're going to get angry about, and that's what we're going to comment on, and all that. And now that I've just been thinking about my friends and my tribe and my people, when I come back and look at them, I see guys who are really smart and really accomplished, and I'm just watching them sucked up in that same cycle. Like, this is what we're going to talk about today, and they're you know that they're emotionally angry about this thing that someone told them to be angry about, and things that they have no control over. And, I think that's one of the biggest challenges, is to separate yourself from that and bring it back and, you know, care more about the people who are close to you and the people who are in your tribe, and, you know, say, you know, I don't really care about that avalanche, you know, for strangers. And a lot of people, that makes you sound like a bad person. But, you know, they don't care about lots of things they don't know about, you know, but they if you don't care about the thing of the day, then you're a bad person. And I think that's, you know, that you're going to face resistance when you talk about things with people, or, you know, you can just kind of, you know, nod your head. I think that's what I do a lot of the time,
right,
in those kind of situations. But I think that's, you know, one of the biggest parts, is to separate yourself from that cycle where you are reacting constantly to all these messages.
Right.
And, react to your own world. And that's hard for people to do, but it's kind of the most important thing. And you have to really, another thing I talk about in the book is you have to figure out who your we is, like who your group is, because most people, you know, they say we, they speak really broadly in these broad democratic American terms of, well, we should do this and we should do that. But those we's don't care about you. They care about you only in the most superficial way. And, you know, like, so, you know, your we should be people who actually care about your opinion and what, and care about your survival and care about what happens to you. You know, and you need to, if you don't know who those people are, you know, you need to find some friends.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think the insidious thing, like, especially with social media, is like people do this, they see these things happen, they get outraged, and like they're commenting, they feel like they're doing something, right?
Yeah.
It's like they're commenting, I'm leaving this comment, I'm, you know, erasing it, but like they're not, I mean, if you think like they're not really doing anything.
No. They're literally emoting. Like they're emoting on command. Because they aren't changing anything. No one cares what they say. And I mean, you know, it's like they'll get someone else to react to what they said. But, you know, even if that's like 5,000 people, it's still kind of a drop in the bucket. You know, it doesn't really matter. It's not going to change the world. So just, you know, stop reacting to those things.
Yeah. And it's like wasted energy. Like you're getting angry and it's like you're wasting, like emotions are like what drives us to like actually take action. And you're wasting that that energy on nothing.
Yeah. I mean, that's the point I make in the book, is actually like caring is a resource. You can only care about so much. So you really need to be selective about what you care about, because you should be caring about other things, you know, and that's, you know, the time you spent caring about that thing that doesn't matter is time that you could be giving to people who are going to give something back to you.
It's wedding season. And while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. Spring is here and the McKays are going to be really busy. I'm coaching flag football again. My daughter's playing basketball. And on those nights when we don't have time to cook a full meal and clean up, we like to eat Factor meals. Factor meals are ready-to-eat meals that are on the table in less than 2 minutes. They're fresh, they're not frozen, they're chef-crafted and dietitian-approved. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You just simply heat and savor the good stuff. And all these meals are really, really nutritious. They're macro-friendly if you're tracking your macros. That's another reason why I like them. So we've been using Factor meals for a while. One thing I've enjoyed lately is the green chili chicken. Super tasty. I also like the creamy mushroom chicken and rice. Very good. It also comes with garlic green beans. And again, you just warm these things up in 2 minutes, and then you have this really delicious meal. And best of all, cleanup's a breeze. If you want to try this out, head to factormeals.com/manliness50 and use code manliness50, that's manliness50, to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's a good deal. That's code manliness50, manliness50 at factormeals.com/manliness50. Get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to, you know, set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Right. Yeah, there was a great essay we republished on the site. And it said, like, when these sort of things happen, you read in the newspaper, it was published by the guy who was like the founder of psychology, James, William James. You know, if you see these events in the newspaper, like a ship sinks or this travesty, like, it's okay to feel like sad or upset, right? Because that's human. But like, go do something with that. Like, find someone nearby, like, that you know, and actually take that and like do something there, like in your locus of control, so you don't waste that emotion. And I thought that was a really good idea. So now whenever like something, I see something happens that kind of tinges me and like makes me feel bad, like I'll try to do something constructive where I'm at. It might not even be related to the tragedy, but like it might be, I'm going to go check in on my neighbor, or I'm going to go call, you know, someone who needs to be called or whatever.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a good way to go.
So this idea of tribe, you know, online you see people saying, "Hey, join my online tribe." Is tribe possible online, or do you need to be face to face?
Join my secret tribe. What are you, a cop?
Right.
It's, you know, because you don't know those people. You can't trust them. I mean, you know, if you are really going to be a tribe with somebody, I mean, they know you. They know who you are. They know, you know, that's what friendship is, right? I mean, it's a certain level of vulnerability that, you know, they've, you know, seen you in the good times and the bad times, and you guys have history. And, you know, well, they can see your good and bad, you know, Facebook status updates, and you could have deep conversations about things. I mean, there's a difference between a person-to-person relationship and an online relationship, because we can kind of be whoever we want to be online. You know, I mean, I know a lot of younger guys are brilliantly funny online. They are great. They are on point. They make me laugh and they are funny. And then they're much quieter in person, you know, and I'm the same way to a certain extent. I mean, I've spent a lot of time online. I'm a writer, but you know, I'm a little bit more, you know, calm and reserved in person. And, you know, so, you know, your friend knows that, you know, they know that there's more than one side of you, but, you know, online people only know that one side of you. And, you know, you can start, you know, obviously like some of the people that I'm oath to, I only know about because I've been online and, you know, and met them online and contacted them because, you know, the online world is a great way to find people who have similar interests to you. And to get, you know, kind of put a flag out there and say, but, you know, you can't really consider them a tribe. They're not really your friends until you actually know them in person. I mean, a good example that I've seen, there's this, it used to be Arthur's Hall of Viking Manliness.
Yeah, I remember that site.
Yeah. And then there's a group of guys that kind of kept it going. It's called the Hall of Manly Excellence. And those guys, I mean, they've been on forums together for so long that they actually have their own culture. You know, they have their own jokes. They have, you know, I've hung out with them in person because they eventually do get together in person, you know, and a lot of those guys, have, you know, met up and hung out in person. And they have, you know, in the way that you, with your old friend, you'll be like, remember this time that blah, 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 blah. Well, they're talking about something that happened online, but, you know, it's like this shared experience that they all have to talk about. And they have this kind of shared culture and these, you know, almost like, you know, shared words and slangs and things. And, you know, that's really cool that, you know, that's, you know, the level to which culture can be created in, you know, online is pretty amazing. But I think until it really reaches the in-person level, it's, you know, all, you know, it kind of subject to that real life interaction, because, you know, again, like I said, you can, to meet a guy who's really, really cool, you know, online, and you know, you find out he's a jerk in real life, or he's a mess. His life isn't together at all, and you know, he's got all these other issues that you know he's kind of hidden in the background online. You know, so you know, I think that to really know someone, I think you have to spend time with them in person, and yeah. that takes a lot of hard work.
And the online thing, like, it's easy to step out, right? You can say, I belong to this group, but like, you can just go silent for a week, 2 weeks, and
oh, yeah,
no one's gonna,
yeah, care. And again, I think you know, that's the thing with tribes, it all comes back to a shared fate. And if you know, if you can't step out, if you really have to answer to that person, and that's why, you know, I'll probably write something about this at some point. If one of my guys from my tribe doesn't beat me to it, he's my buddy Paul Wagner has been putting out a lot of great YouTube videos about the tribe, and he's been running our tribe for 10 years, you know, with his brother. So, you know, he knows a lot about it, and he's had to deal with a lot of this stuff. And you know, I think one of the things that really made a difference for me personally is the oath. You know, if you take an oath to something, you have to deal with that. And in many ways, my writing has been a series of oaths because, you know, I have to kind of stand by my words. I can't be, I'm like, well, I said this is what people should do, so now I actually have to do it. And sometimes that sucks. And so I kind of hold myself accountable to things that I've written. And in the same way, like an oath is, you know, you have, men are pretty good at realizing that, yeah, I said this thing, so I kind of have to stand by it or figure out a way that I don't have to. And, you know, I think if there's a bunch of guys who are going to hold you accountable to that oath, that's a big difference from kind of this kind of superficial, transient relationship that a lot of people have, where they're just kind of, they go in and out of social circles, whether online or in real life. I mean, people always say, oh, I have my mom boys, I have my buddies and whatever. It's like, you know, are they really going to be there for you? I mean, yeah, you're that's your drinking buddy, or that's your watching sports buddy or whatever. But, you know, they can back out because they don't have a reason why they can't.
Yeah.
And I think the oath is a good reason why they can't. I mean, I've already been called into some situations that I was like, I would not be in by choice. But, you know, it's like, well, I said I was going to be there, so I'm there.
You're there. Yeah, that's some heavy stuff. So, you know, throughout the book, you call modern culture the empire of nothing, which sounds completely, I guess, is why the guy who said this book is depressing, one of the reasons why he probably says depressing. So why do you call modern culture an empire of nothing?
Because there's a lack of positive identity as much as anything. Because we don't have that tribalism, there is no, they talk about modern culture. I'm like, well, what is that? There is no culture really. It's just a series of kind of products, you know, whether entertainment products or whatever that we string together. And that's kind of, you know, TV shows and so forth are what we all have in common, but we don't have a shared identity. You know, people have a bunch of mini identities that are, you know, flexible and you can do away with. And so, you know, like, that's what I mean by an empire of nothing. Like, it's an empire without identity. You know, in the way that the Roman Empire, you know, started in Rome, it's a Roman culture. And even though they assimilated a lot of different groups of people, they maintained that central culture. You knew you were a subject of Rome and what it meant to be Roman. And there was a Roman culture that went with that package. And I feel like America, to a certain extent, I mean, that's what we share with the world. And that's you know, the wrong use of we for me. But, you know, what Americans share with the world is that they, you know, it's just a consumer culture in many ways. And it's, I always say that it's a lot of negative rights. Like, well, we don't do this and we don't do that and we don't do that. But, and so it's like, there is no one religion. There is no one culture. There is no one single thing that can define it. And so it just becomes kind of this, thing that's very, very malleable and very subject to consumer interest. As we talked about identity earlier, you know, this culture that's spreading really isn't anything. It just tries to be everything to everyone. And to actually have an identity, to say, like, you know, like the Italians or the French, you know, to have a culture like that, you need to be separate, because it can't just be everything. In the way that a word, to have a definition, it, you know, to have a definition, a word has to be not something else. You know, it has to have a boundary. Yeah. Like a word can't mean everything or anything that you want it to mean. It's just, it means one thing. And, you know, that's what I'm getting at is nothing. You're like, if you can't say these people are in and these people are out, then you don't actually have a culture. You have just this growing kind of mass of, you know, human flesh.
The monoculture. So I mean, like,
yeah, exactly.
When you read your stuff, Jackson, someone can get the impression that like you're like against modern civilization completely, right? But like, you know, modern civilization is allowing us to do Skype, do this conversation. It's allowed both of us to get our writings out to people in a very unrestricted way, and so on. So I mean, is civilization all bad, or like? So I mean, what's the approach of a guy like who wants to sort of take this, you know, tribal mentality, and like they want to have a group where they're not, they create a group culture that means something, but while still living in modern society and enjoying its benefits.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the point. I mean, you can't escape modern society. They'll find you with a drone. There is nowhere to go. We have drones and satellites and I think I said in the book at some point, like if you run off into the wilderness somewhere, there's really no guarantee that they're not going to set up condos, you know, a mile from where you set up your little Shangri-La where you hide from the world. There's no way to escape modernity. And that's what a lot of people, you know, then say it's hypocritical. Oh, well, you use technology or this and that. And I'm not against technology. I mean, a bow and arrow is technology. We've always had technology. And I wrote about this in The Way of Men a little bit. You know, masculinity has always been kind of in conflict with how much technology is too much. How much technology makes us weak, and you know, how do we become too reliant on it? And that's always a, you know, debate that men have had. But in terms of how much civilization is too much, I feel like you know, there's a sweet spot, and I think we're far past it. I think most people are far past that sweet spot. You know, I think the governments are far too intrusive and so forth. And in order for that to change, it'll have to switch the other way. And, you know, that'll be uncomfortable. In terms of, you know, civilization itself isn't always bad. Like I said, there's a sweet spot. In terms of technology, I feel like you have to use the tools that you have to create the world that you want. And, you know, so you can't be one of these guys who like, well, that's part of the modern world, so I won't touch that, because it's always going to be very cherry picked anyway. I mean, everything you have comes to you from the modern world, unless you live on some homestead somewhere. And even that, you bought all the stuff that you started the homestead with from the modern world. There's no way to not do that. So it's kind of ridiculous. So what you need to do is choose what is important to you and what, you know, has the values of your group. And then use these other tools that modernity offers and realize the way the world actually works and use them to your advantage rather than to your disadvantage, you know, rather than allowing, you know, people want to be pure of the contagion of modernity. And, you know, that puts them at a disadvantage, and then they just kind of like become hermits.
Right.
And, you know, then they're just going to be another, you know, hermit that's forgotten and no one cares about. So if you want to actually make an impact on the world and you know, do something, make your tribe glorious, as we would say, you know, you have to use the tools that are available to you. I mean, yeah, I mean, my skill set is very modern in some ways. I mean, I'm really good at the Adobe suite and you know, I mean, that's stuff that I can nerd out on a computer all day long. But, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, that's how I make my t-shirts. I mean, I'm even like, you know, I'm against globalism. And people would say that this is hypocritical, but, you know, I'm for my tribe. And, you know, because my tribe is what matters to me, you know, I don't care where my products come from. You know, like I'm going to get the best deal so I can put the most money back into my tribe. And that's at the end of the day, I think that's what's most important to me is helping those, you know, my tribe to create the world that we want to live in and, you know, use the money to buy property and hang out.
Right. I mean, this sounds like a very Amish approach. I think, you know, a lot of people have this misconception about the Amish, like they're completely anti-technology. They're not. Like they've incorporated modern technology into their culture, but like they're just very intentional about it. Like they'll think about it a lot and say, will this negatively affect our way of life? If not, we'll use it. And if it, you know, if there's a chance it could negatively affect our way of life, like they'll put like serious rules about how you use it. I mean, you don't have to get bonkers like it like that, but like, I think just being intentional, right?
About, that's a great way to think about it. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's like, is this harming us or hurting us? You know, and so many, I mean, that's, you know, the discussion about Facebook. I mean, Facebook and social media, is this good? Is this, you know, is this making me a better person? Or that's why I like Instagram better, but they're all by the same people. So it's not like I'm, you know,
you're not escaping them.
I'm not escaping them. I just like this group, this particular platform is, you know, better for me right now. And, you know, it kind of highlights the things that are, you know, fun and important to me, that, you know, the culture that I'm kind of trying to spread in the world.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you just make choices about what's working for you and what's, you know, what's working from a business perspective, what's working for a personal perspective, what makes you a better person, and, you know, what's dragging you down into cycles of emoting about things that don't matter or, you know, like just hurting you in other ways.
Right. Be intentional. Cause I think most people just don't even think about it. They just like, oh, everyone else is doing it, so I'll do it too.
Yeah. 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 Like I was intentional about Snapchat. I looked at it and I tried it.
Yeah.
And I tried, I'm like, how can I make this work for me? And I'm like, I got nothing. Yeah. I'm like, this is stupid. I hate it.
That's how I felt. Like I tried it too. Everyone's like, yeah, get on Snapchat. So like, I got it. And like, I feel weird. Like, just like talking into the camera. I was like, I can't do this.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, occasionally I could see a purpose for it. And Instagram just stole their features anyway. So,
right.
You know, I guess I'll use it in that way whenever possible.
Whenever you're possible. Yeah. I tried that out and I'm like, this is kind of weird. I don't know. Something about it's weird. I can't put my finger on it. Anyways, that's a distraction.
It's a little too reality TV for me. But
yeah, right there.
I like to know what I'm saying or why I'm doing it when I do it. But I guess, you know, I should be more anti-fragile and
embrace
the chaos.
Embrace it. So, I mean, if there's a guy listening to this and they're like, yeah, you know, I have this itch for camaraderie, community, tribe, you know, having a gang. I mean, how do they go about it? I mean, like, what do they build a tribe around? I mean, is it an activity? Is it a set of ideals, faith? You know, what do you build the tribe around?
Well, I think all of those things. A lot of people, you know, and it's again a very American way of thinking, is that you know all those things don't matter. It's just whether we like each other and we're friends. Well, they kind of does. I mean, because when you talk about, you know, philosophy or religion, all those things they determine what your idea of good is and how you're going to make decisions and what's important to you. So I think that you really have to find people who share those values or who are willing to say, okay, that's fine. That's close enough. And that's a lot of what joining a tribe involves. I mean, you're going to have to say, that's fine. That's close enough. It's not going to be perfect. Nothing's perfect. You know, you're just going to have to, you know, get involved and, you know, if there's things that are slightly off, you either adjust to them or, you know, try and, you know, like, you know, adapt to them in any way that you can. But, you know, yeah, you got to look for people who have similar values. And a lot of people also, you got to avoid the little, you know, the mini kind of Hitler thing, you know, where, you know, you always have the guy who wants to be the leader real bad. And that's why he wants to have a tribe, is to be the leader. And, you know, that's kind of that's always going to be a bad leader.
Right.
So, I mean, you have to, you know, find people with the right skills to do the right job. And, the people who want to be part of something and they want to create something, they have to commit to this kind of this similar vision of what this tribe could be. And the other thing that the problem that they run into is that they try to over plan, like what is our great society going to look like? And, you know, you're going to hit a lot of bumps along the road until you get to your magical society where everything is perfect. So, you know, you just have to kind of have a shared vision and, you know, kind of like the same things. And, you know, as important as anything, it's like when we're looking at prospects, in my chapter out here, it's like, do I like hanging out with this guy? That's also hugely important. It's like, there are a lot of people that maybe share our values, but, you know, if you don't like them, then, you know, you're just going to not like them even more when you're oath to them forever.
Right.
You know, you have to actually, you know, like, you know, surround yourself with people whose company you enjoy as well, which is a big point. I think a lot of people trying to force it too quick And, you know, you don't make friends overnight. And so, you know, maybe you just have two or three friends that you just start your thing with, and you don't try to start a group, you know, that's at Dunbar's number yet. You know, you don't go out to 150 or whatever. You know, you just have to slowly build and build those friendships and decide what you want together. And, you know, it's everybody wants to, like, how can I, you know, sign up tomorrow, or how can I, you know, start this, you know, and have a tribe by next week. And it's a lot of work. I can tell you, like, I think we talked earlier, and I said, you know, it takes I about 5 full days a month is probably what I put in right now to, you know, run and to, you know, and talk, you know, and deal with the tribe and the logistics and what everybody needs and where everybody's going to be. And so-and-so lost their job, and so just got a job, and so-and-so just moved, and, you know, we have to help this guy. And, you know, there's a lot of work that is involved in being part of a tribe. So you have to be willing to do that work, and it takes a lot of time. It doesn't happen overnight, and most people aren't going to have that kind of commitment. And if you find the people who do, you're lucky.
Yeah, that's cool. And it's like, what do they do when they get together? I mean, it's just like you said, like, don't base around just an activity, but like guys, like when they get together, they like to do stuff.
I mean, that's super important. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we've probably both read most of the same books. Men bond, you know, when they're aggressing against something, or, you know, creating something or building something, you know, shoulder to shoulder. And I think that, you know, creating a project like that, I mean, it's, you know, it's easy, you know, if you have some kind of training thing, like obviously, like I've done a lot of tactical training and so forth, although you don't want to say you're starting a militia because that's kind of bad, but that's kind of creates trouble. But, you know, you get together, you know, with your guys and work on some training things. You work on, learning some fighting skills, maybe. I mean, a lot of what we've been doing, because we've had, you know, opportunity to construct some things on land and make the land better. A lot of us, you know, I get guys who will just show up and we'll work all day, you know, putting down mulch or moving. We need a path over here. We need this. We need to create this so that when people come, they have somewhere to sit, you know, stuff like that. You know, that brings people together because they're all working together constantly. And, you know, funny stuff, things happen when you work together and you react to each other in a certain way. And I think that definitely helps people bond. So, you know, it's not going to be the same. Like I said, that there is no template, but, you know, if based on what your values are, what do you want to create? And, you know, the more, I know Paul Wagner always says, you know, you need land, you need a space, you need somewhere to go that isn't, that doesn't belong to somebody else, you know, and everything really belongs to something else. They belongs to the bank or the government, really. But, you know, as much as you can possibly own something in this world, you need to find a space and organize your resources in order to do that. And that's a project in itself.
All right.
So, you know, it's for everybody's going to be different. Obviously, a religious group is going to try and build something at a church. You know, we kind of have something similar going on with ours, but we also want a place where we can train and all kinds of things. So you have to find out what the priorities of your group are and, you know, start the project. And in many ways, that's going to be the way you bond. What you don't want, and I think that this is a big pitfall with a lot of people, is that it's really easy to start a drinking club.
Right.
And, you know, and that can be part of it. I mean, that's men have been doing that for all of history, and that's cool. But it has to be more than that. Otherwise, you just have a drinking club. Yeah. You know, you just have the guys that you get drunk with, and that's not really, you know, terribly productive in and of itself. So you need to have something beyond that to do, you know, together.
Gotcha. All right. So I guess like to kind of summarize, like, get started, just do something, little steps, expect it to be hard. You don't have to have the plan, the grand plan from the get-go. It sort of develops organically, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So, I mean, okay, let's talk about this. So I think I had Sebastian Younger on the podcast, came out with his new book, Tribe, and he talks about all these psychological, sociological benefits that come from being embedded in a tightly knit community. Like, people are less crazy, you're happier, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's often easy too to overlook some of the downsides of being in a community. You kind of hit on this a little bit. You know, there's friction, there's going to be conflict, people annoy you. It's like family. Right.
Oh yeah. It is absolutely like family.
So, I mean, how do, what's the best way? How do you guys manage, or like, how should guys manage this friction effectively? Cause like in most, if you belong to like some sort of group, like you can, if you don't like it, you bounce out. Like there's no commitment. So you just stop going. So what do you do to ensure that doesn't happen?
Well, you know, I mean, it's like a relationship. You have to want to be there, you know, if you all have the commitment that we're doing this thing, then you have to work out your problems. You know, you have to actually, you know, and then something will come up and someone does leave. I mean, it happens. But, we've have guys that, you know, a lot of that's what I've done kind of a lot of as a leader in our group is kind of deal with conflicts, you know, like what are you like try and, you know, make everybody understand each other. Like these guys are getting kind of, you know, this guy is getting mad at this guy and I can see it. And so they're going to need to find some common ground here pretty quick or they're going to have a problem. And that's a lot of what you have to do is kind of figure out, manage those conflicts and find a way to be in it together. And like you said, it's the same as a family. I mean, you know, any family you're going to have like, well, you know, Uncle Bob's doing his thing again.
Right.
But so we're just going to wait this out because it'll be done in a little while. And, you know, everybody has their thing. You know, everybody has something that they do that's going to annoy other people or something that, you know, that people don't like about them. And so, you know, you just have to accept that not everyone's perfect and they're all going to have their own little quirks and kind of put it in a bigger perspective. As long as that commitment's there. You know, you make it work. Like I said, it's a, you know, like a relationship or like a marriage. I mean, you have to have that commitment to the final, you know, the goal to belonging to that relationship or that marriage or that tribe. And when you do, then you have to just find ways to work it out. And it's going to be different for everybody. But you know, you have to be wary of, you know, conflicts before they get to the worst possible point.
Right. All right. So it takes work. This is not for the faint of heart.
No. I mean, like I said, it's at least a part-time job. Yeah.
Well, cool. Hey, Jack, this has been a great conversation. Where can people get the book?
Oh, the new book, just on Amazon. And, you know, I have, occasionally I put up signed copies and so forth through my new, company. It's called Brutal Co, Brutal Company. So brutalco.com. And, you know, obviously jack-donovan.com is where, you know, you find all kinds of news about what I'm doing. And since we talked about Instagram, it's at Start the World.
At Start the World. Yeah. And you can see Jack's luscious garden, backyard farm. He has.
It's like punching things, shooting things, gardening.
And then you were telling me earlier, you were canning earlier today.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe I'll put some pictures of canning up today. I don't know. I just did a bunch of that. I mean, you know, it's all part of the, you know, learning, you know, how the world really works.
Right. Being self-sufficient. Well, hey, Jack, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
All right, man. Thanks.
My guest today is Jack Donovan. He's the author of the books, The Way of Men and Becoming a Barbarian. They're available on Amazon.com. Also check out the show notes at aom.is/barbarian for links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. Our show is edited by Creative Audio Lab here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you need audio editing needs or audio production needs, check them out at creativeaudiolab.com. As always, I appreciate your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.